This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Wake up, San Francisco. I'm Danny Tanner. Welcome to the show today. Happy New Week, everybody. Jake Reiner. We're going to be talking about the Reiner situation here. First, your thoughts. We'd love for you to weigh in out there on the comment section. Jake Reiner wrote about waking up every morning and having to convince himself it wasn't a dream. He put out a new a piece this week. It's the first time he's spoken publicly on his Substack. The article is just called Mom and Dad. He wrote about being robbed of his parents at his wedding, of grandchildren they'll never hold. Meanwhile, reports say the brother accused of taking all of that from him is allegedly plotting a revenge tell-all from his jail cell, not to seek justice, not to take responsibility, but reportedly to settle scores with the very people who spent years trying to save him. So when a family pours everything into someone dangerous and loses everything because of it, at what point does the person left standing get to stop carrying the weight of someone else's destruction? That is what we are getting into in our first segment this morning. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, my co-host with us as always. Good morning.
Yeah. Happy Monday. What a busy weekend.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. With everything going on, with everything we're covering, and then in between all that, the assassination attempt and everything, you know, Tony and I are going back and forth watching more of our cult specials on TV, too.
Yeah. It all comes up to, I mean, everything just comes down to really unhealthy minds. That's where we end up with everybody.
At the same time, though, it helps you appreciate what you do have. Every time you watch and absorb and digest what's going on in the world around you, it gives you context to see what is healthy and what's unhealthy, so you know what to attach yourself with, who to interact with, and know what to tolerate or not tolerate in your life. I think that's one of the greatest things about doing what we do is we give some recognition for everyone tuning in to what's right and what's not right when it comes to who should we have in our lives and what we should do about it.
Yeah, 1,000%. We're taking your questions on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us live. We also have several of your questions that you've dropped on our videos over the last week or two. We're going to try and get to a handful of those here as we work through this live today. But please do drop them. All right, let's just start with this one, the first one. It's something I think a lot of people have thought about when they've looked at this case. It says, I keep thinking about that smirk at the arraignment, speaking about Nick Reiner when he was in court. This is at you, Robin. You study people for a living. What does a guy who reportedly can't process why he's in jail but still wants to write a revenge book actually look like from a behavioral standpoint? Because those two things don't go together in my head. Danielle on Instagram asks that question.
I keep things as simple as possible in all this. I'm not the lawyer. I'm not licensed psychotherapist like our great Siobhan is. So I just break it down into this. That is one broken brain.
Yum.
It really comes down to that. It is a sick MF-er. It really is. And I don't think there's any fix in it. And I know this comes up with one of the questions later. Mm-hmm. Medications that they kept trying with him and are continue to try with him are band-aids for the underlying broken brain. It is an unfixable brain in that head. And so I just think it comes down to that. There's no reasoning with it. There's no having it shift. We haven't seen it yet. Why would we see a shift in his behavior pattern? Remember, past is prologue with a lot of people. And even though we all learn and we're not the same people today as we were yesterday, you can kind of see those arcs, those trajectories. It's why I always go to behavior arcs and life arcs of people, because people are not going to have these major shifts out of that unless there's some event that they have this aha epiphany. Mm-hmm. And even with an aha epiphany, that rudder starts shifting slightly. It's not like today I'm a horrible human being that is a wound collecting, victimizing person with a broken brain to tomorrow I have this epiphany. And in other words, it's not a Scrooge moment from Christmas Carol where he has three dreams in the middle of the night and wakes up fixed in the morning. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen for many people ever.
It needs to, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great if, like, that story actually worked out and people learned from their horrible mistakes of being massive narcissists their whole life and suddenly they wake up one morning and, like, I'm better.
It's a fascinating thing, too. So we can look at patterns behavior across society, across everything, to really understand what we can reasonably expect in every situation. Does anyone watching, listening, tuning in, does anyone ever know someone in their life that went from 0 to 100? Went from completely broken to the next day they woke up full accountability and fixed? The closest you'll come is to like a drug addict, alcoholic, or something like that that has their rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And they make the decision that they are broken and they're going to save their own lives by going to meetings, getting clean, going to detox. And then the rudder shifts and they stop consuming the horrible things that are destroying them, and they start the first step on their journey to come out of it. And it doesn't go from 0 to, oh, I get it. It goes from 0 to the first step, the second step, and it's days, weeks, months, and years to crawl yourself up out of that mess you created yourself into being a functioning, more healthy human being that can have a reasonable expectation of a great relationship with another human being. But for Nick Reiner, ain't happening. I mean, how many times has he hit rock bottom only to be saved and coddled by others?
Well, I guess maybe that is the question I think that some people have is has he ever really truly hit rock bottom? I mean, there are stories where he was homeless. He's talked about it, but they aren't like, there are not stretches of homelessness, I think, that a lot of people who are homeless experience. Like, he always kind of had a safety net to kind of go back on. It's like homeless light. Tried it out for a little bit, was like, this is a bit much for me, and then wandered back to the shelter of his parents and those who could essentially keep him from ever hitting rock bottom. And drugs were involved in much of Nick Reiner's existence. What's scariest to me about people like Nick Reiner and people not like Nick Reiner but still have the same sort of pathology and all that is the folks with the drug addiction and things of that nature. Sometimes, like you were saying, if they can get themselves cleaned up, if they can get on a good path, There can be some paths to redemption. Hmm. What's more scary, the folks where drugs are not involved at all, and this is just how they are. because you remove some of that and the weight that the drugs are having on the brain, and like suddenly things can clear up a bit. When it's like this is just your normal mode of thinking all the time, that's even scarier. And I feel like obviously drugs are a big part of the story with Nick Reiner, but I think even you take the drugs out of the equation with Nick Reiner, because there were moments of sobriety here, and he was still a very broken person, and still very much someone who didn't seem to ever truly take the accountability for his actions.
And
that
even
were
right now.
Yeah, even right now.
He's in isolation, eating crappy food, in jail, no drugs involved anymore.
True.
And
plotting.
He's still the victim in his own mind. No account. I mean, you don't, what other bottom can you hit except death? You know, I think he's addicted to bouncing on the bottom. He just loves dwelling there. He loves, I mean, think about this. Besides that broken brain, which I think is unfixable because people, they paid a lot of money to try to fix it, ain't fixed yet. Mm-hmm. Why else continue? He's addicted to being the victim. He loves it. He's thriving in it. Otherwise, why would you continue it unless you're incapable of moving out of it because your brain is so chemical imbalances, malformations, whatever it is up there that, you know, people like Siobhan love to diagnose and can diagnose much more effectively. But again, if they could diagnose it so well, they would have fixed it or made attempts to fix it and it just hasn't worked. Who knows? But ain't working.
I mean, recognizing the problem doesn't mean you're fixing the problem. You know, you can go, there's a giant hole in the side of the Titanic and it's sinking. Well, if we got it into dry dock, we could cover that up with new metal and make it float. It's already sinking. It's in the middle of the ocean. Just knowing that is what would be the fix doesn't mean you can implement it. And I think that's very true with some people, including Nick Reiner. Another question we have here, Jake said he'd trade, this is Jake Reiner, Nick's brother, said he'd trade every Dodger game and every Broadway show just to talk to his parents one more hour. In that, and I highly recommend reading it on Substack. I restacked his post so you can find it on ours. The link is in the description for Substack. It's a really, I mean, heartfelt piece about his parents. So he's talking about all those memories and everything that he shared with them. How do you even begin to grieve people you lost to violence when the person who allegedly took them is your own brother, and he's still finding ways to hurt you from inside the cell? That's a question from Rachel on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know. I think everyone does it differently. To me, I mean, and I've seen this in other cases, and I think I would do it in my own life. You just have to cut him off. I mean, he's not as, that's not your brother. That's something inhuman in there. It's just, I don't know how it looks like he was this way a very long time, but that's not your brother. That's not a human being. That's someone, it's something that is a toxic cancer in your life. And you just have to treat it like that. You've got to cut it out. You know, some people, and we see this with the cults. We saw it with Amy Duggar when we interviewed her and other family members. We want to give a lot of grace to family, but I always ask myself, why? You know, I mean, seriously, you can really see some really unhealthy, toxic things. And if you keep associating with it, again, it's not, there's a choice. It's not right or wrong or better or worse. I can just tell you the impact if you keep associating with it or keep allowing it to infect your brain. And I didn't say infect your brain because that's exactly what it's taking up, that gray matter. It's taking up bandwidth. It's taking up space. You know, if you just regard it as a broken tool that is no longer servicing me, you got to cut it out. Because I tell you what, he's not viewing him as his brother. He's not viewing him as anything but a tool that he can try to manipulate for his own gain, for his own pleasure. Because the only pleasure Nick Reiner is getting, again, pure conjecture at this point, is inflicting, continuing to inflict pain and discomfort on others. Because what has he done his entire life? Inflict pain and discomfort on others. He seems to enjoy it. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it anymore. Why is he getting it? Broken brain, whatever. But it's... We allow people to infect us when we accept them still in our lives. Just cut that crap out, man. And I'm sorry for them hugely. And I know it's tough for family members, people to do that. But if you keep accepting unhealthy in your life, it's going to be painful. Unless you have the ability to at least sit back and, as I say multiple times a day, watch a show. I can be very close to people, close proximity. I can listen to words. I can have great conversations. But because I assess who they are, what they stand for, and all these myriad of things, their words don't have impact on me because that's their thoughts, their beliefs, their position in life, and it'll just roll right over me like water. No, but now if someone I do feel close to, I mean, like you, Tony, Todd, our crew here, my wife, my family, my kids, what they say, what their opinion matters very deeply to me. I cannot actually take an action in my life without one of these close people in my life being part of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're part of my very tight circle, it's tight. And there's a huge bar of good, healthy relationships that you have to meet to be there. But other than that, I enjoy the show. People got great words. Some have horrible words. I take it all in, assess it, and then it rolls right over like water. Hard to do. Takes a lot of reps. But in order to preserve yourself, because you can't be there for others if you allow people like that to infect your life.
Do you think the no, and this is me, we're in an interesting place right now in the span of human history. The whole no contact thing with your family wasn't even, I mean, just 20, 30 years ago. It was like, what? Oh, my God, who would do that? And if you go further back, you can kind of understand why people weren't doing that. It was out of necessity. It was more so like survival. It didn't matter if you had some narcissistic asshole person in your family. If you needed them to survive, you needed them to survive, and you had to figure out a way to make everybody, well, the cogs in the wheel work together, even if some weren't. We're not in a world like that anymore. We don't need all the cogs in this wheel to function, to survive. If you have a family member that's just a bad apple or whatever you want to call them, flat out evil, you don't need them. You don't have to keep absorbing them. But I don't know that we've mentally caught up to that reality yet. I feel like we're getting there. I think it's interesting. Oprah just did a piece on this, piece on this about families going no contact and what that means and why people are doing that. Because there's a huge percentage of people that are doing it far more than ever have in the past with family members that have been toxic. People that have decided to stop accepting unhealthy.
Yeah.
Is this just something? Do you think we're going to get better at this as time goes on? Because it's not required, and we're not. I think a lot of people stay by unhealthy out of shame, and by out of guilt. But but guilt and shame that are, I think, very much misplaced, that aren't necessarily accurate to the situation, but because we're told we should feel guilty or shameful for telling an unhealthy family member to go away and go over there. I feel like that dynamic is shifting.
I do too, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah.
We are genetically and biologically coded for group tribal mentality. It's part, like you said, it's part of our survival. Ancient tribal man, if you didn't belong to the close-knit society, close-knit group, close-knit family, the chances of you being able to procreate and pass on your genetic coding was slim to none. Mm-hmm. So we're coded to want to unconditionally accept and believe in and be around that close family structure. But to your point, because society is so evolved with community, with government, with businesses, with organizations, the mechanisms for survival are in place outside of family. Now, family is a great thing to have if it's healthy. What I really like about this is that, and Amy Duggar talked about it when we chatted with her, yeah, it's breaking the toxic cycle. It's breaking the cycle internally of the trauma response family that's constantly, because I don't know the percentage. It's very high. I think it's 85 to 95% of child S abusers come from a place where they were introduced to it at a young age, either by a family member or someone close to that family. So that's where you break the trauma cycle. When you break that trauma cycle with healthy relationships, you have to distance yourself from that original family. And then what are you doing? You're aligning with new family. You're aligning with a new spouse, with a healthier spouse. And so then you can recollect the family, and then family can be close again because you broke the trauma cycle. Yeah. So I think it's taking families that were broken for generational trauma, breaking it, because it takes courage, it takes strength, and it takes a lot of effort and bravery to have the courage to break that trauma cycle, that generational trauma cycle, and then start a new cycle with a new family. And then we can actually go back to this. So those great, wonderful family values will allow us to do what? Feel safe, feel seen, feel heard, and be valued by others. But when you're in that toxic generational cycle, it doesn't happen. And I think that's what people are starting to do. They're starting to have the courage because, you know, as detrimental as social media can be and all this online stuff we have, at the same time, it's able to get messages out like the people like the Jill Duggars and the Amy Duggar Kings that were able to escape the trauma cycles, and, you know, and people that are able to escape FDLS, and even in this situation, brothers that are able to break from toxic other brothers that have destroyed families, that had murdered their parents, you know, break that cycle, get out, move on. And I think that's what's going to be hopefully a resurgence using what could be negative and use it for positive.
I agree. I think that is, it's a very healthy way of looking at things in a way that essentially has been shunned, I think, in society for a long time. You don't think that way. That you don't even entertain this idea.
Right.
When in reality, that's the way to freedom, if
don't
you
do
want.
Crazy.
You
know?
Yeah.
Just don't do crazy.
Just don't do crazy. Make that your policy in life. Don't do crazy. Keep them out. And don't be afraid to say, no, I'm done. I mean, it feels like a lot of life, almost, I don't know, in some ways of looking at it, some generations, it's almost like, how long have you known these people? Life is not a race, and it's not a contest of how long have you had certain people in your life, because at the end of the day, there's no prize for having toxic people in your life until you're dead. You're going to be much more happier by the time death comes if you had exchanged some of those toxic people for healthy people. There's only so much bandwidth you have to give and take out there. Why not spend it with healthy people, not the unhealthy?
So I'm going to give everyone, and I've read, I can't remember what exact book that I read this. I read so many books, but here is exactly the win for life. If you want to, everyone is pursuing a successful life, a happy life. And it's easy to get caught up in the materialism of the world and have someone else define for you what success is, with monetary gain, prestige, title, accolades, all the things that you didn't come into the world with and you're not leaving with. Mm-hmm. So how do you cannot measure success by those things. There's only really one thing alone I believe you can measure success in. And that is how you're remembered, the type of person you are, Do you want to be remembered as this great professional, or you want to be remembered as someone that couldn't, that lit up a room when you came around that corner, that's always there for someone else? And most importantly, the greatest gift you can give yourself and give others, the only thing you'll leave, is what you taught others about how to treat others, how to be present for them, how to be kind, how to have grace, how to do all these things that help others have healthy, strong relationships. That is what success is. That's what the life win is. What are you going to do to inspire other people to live a healthier life so they can pass it on generationally to the people in their lives? That is what's going to move, that's what's going to move our species forward beyond what it is now with constantly this. Mm-hmm. And why is it this? Because we are constantly caught up in these toxic things. It doesn't matter. You can't take any of this crap with you. So focus on those relationships. Be that beacon that people want to gravitate to, and then to pass on those skills to those that matter in your life, and those new family structures form around. There, I'm done my soapbox for the day, right?
So if you don't want more of this, get more of that. Buy this book right here. You like that transition right there?
Yes.
Wasn't that fun?
And see, it's not all about me.
Exactly. It's Robin's latest book, and it's available wherever books are sold. Go and check that out. Let's move over to another topic here, another case. The autopsy is out. The charges are filed. And what came out of that courtroom on the one-year anniversary of the last day of Celeste Rivas Hernandez was seen alive. It's worse than most people were prepared for. Prosecutors say they've got 40 terabytes of evidence, a wiretap nobody knew about, three separate grand juries, and exploitation material found directly on his phone. His defense team response, speed it up, step on the gas, show us everything. And the question that won't leave me alone, the one that I think you might be sitting with too, is what were all the adults doing for 12 months between when this child vanished and when someone finally smelled something wrong in a tow yard? Your questions on Substack, on YouTube, drop them. We're going to try and get through them as we look at the David case. Let's start here, Robin. His lawyers are demanding a faster hearing. Strategy. Some people waive the right to speedy. Some are like, let's step on the gas for different reasons. 40 terabytes they haven't apparently seen yet. What do they know that we don't, that they're wanting this to move really fast?
You know, this is such a Bob question.
It is. I mean, it is, but I'm curious to get your conjecture on it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, I looked up, there's a lot of legal reasons for this, that it's definitely unprecedented. Typically, they don't do this fast. They don't want to move this fast. Mm-hmm. But there's one theory that I kind of have in my mind. Because again, you place yourself in that situation. And so I'm going to answer it from a behavioral standpoint, not from a Bob Mata legal standpoint, or our good friend Eric on the prosecution side as well. I think there's so much uh-ohs that have just happened with the release of the autopsy result and the terabytes and what we're seeing for child's S things on his cell phone and things like that. The faster they move, the less that's known in the media. I think it's really about trying to negate or at least lessen the huge negative impact or conjecture and all these things that are coming out. So let's move fast before people see even more. I really think that's part of it, because there is, with that much, think about that, terabytes of information, and none of it is any good. Yeah. None of it's going to be to his benefit. So if you want to not give people time to digest that much data, let's quickly move so you don't get to see that much data, and let's try to get this thing moving. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not diagnosing him innocent until proven guilty, in our opinion, blah, 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 allegedly put that in front of everything. The narcissists don't like their masks slipping. And if David is a narcissist, which it kind of appears that he may be, he seems to have some of the traits, the last thing they want is exposure. And I mean, this is why we've seen so many cases where we get right up to trial and they're professing their innocence right up into the, and then suddenly it's like, oh, guess what? It's showtime. Here comes a spotlight. It's about to shift onto you. I did it. Shut the show down.
Ew. Yeah. AKA Rex Heuermann.
Rex Heuermann, Brian Koberger. I mean, we see it in a lot of cases like
control,
that.
Control.
1,000%. And if that's, and they will exercise any monochrome of control that they can get, because that's big to them. That's all they have left. So it's going to be a big deal, and they're going to go in at full force. So I'm thinking you're right. I think that's probably some level of this. The less that can just linger out there into the ether, the better. But at the end of the day here, I mean, sorry, this shit's going to linger out there forever. Yeah. This is part of the record.
and I think as soon as, I think part of the strategy too, again, we're going to make our list for Bob tomorrow.
Yeah.
I think part of the strategy here could also be for the defense to get all the information for Discovery as fast as they can before the media gets it, so they can make their determination as fast as possible and put a plea deal together. I think, yeah. You know, I know Bob said it last week and the week before as well. I'm leaning on, with this much information, with this many bad things going on, I can't imagine it going to trial. I mean, but you never know on these things. But there's so much information, it looks like. And I think in order to keep control of the narrative, to actually have any potential for a plea deal of any site, I think that's why. I think they just want to move to that as fast as possible so they can actually have a good choice about how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like where we're going to go here is, and this is just my non-legal expertise. My legal expertise comes from talking to Bob a lot.
Right, I know we're channeling our inner Bob.
Yeah, so that's what that, my gut on it is, we're looking at a situation here where death could possibly be on the table.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that might be the only, that's the only, you know, piece that he has on the board to play with anymore is, okay, plead out and we're not going to try you for the death penalty.
Yep.
And you're going to be gone forever, but at least you won't die.
That's the route I'm going to. That's why you and I are aligned, but we'll assault Bob with it tomorrow.
Okay.
Odd question for you guys. I was thinking about that.
Yeah, Todd.
Will he, you know, it seems like there's some dark stuff in this kid's mind, right?
Yeah.
Would he enjoy the death penalty?
Oh, God. Like the process, like being on death row, going for the ride, essentially?
Because that's a long stretch, right? Yeah. That's a long stretch of time.
So it looked like his music videos, very macabre.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a really interesting question. It's really interesting because, I mean, you know, he's going to be creating art around all these things because he's all about the dark imagery. So he's going to be using something with it. I'd be really curious about, and again, now we'll shift on to Siobhan on Wednesday. I wonder about this because people like this have a lot of suicidal idealization a lot of times too. I'd say if he had a suicidal idealization, he might be willing to go down that route. But if he sees himself as the martyred artist behind bars, I think it also be interesting too. Is there a Son of Sam law where he's being convicted? Because he could really profit handsomely behind. I mean, think about the following he has.
I think there is. I mean, it's California. I mean, there is some, whether it's called Son of Sam there, I don't know, but there's something in place.
Right. So he can't profit from, he can't take the proceeds from anything. So I think all those things are what the defense is going to weigh in on that. But really good insight and question, Todd.
I mean, we kind of thought that way about Koberger a little bit too. Like, is he enjoying the ride here? Is this part of what he wanted? But he didn't go for the whole trial. That would be part of the ride, I would think. If you did this, you'd want to go on. But I don't know. I mean, they can kind of pick and choose where they want to use their fast pass, if you will.
And that'll definitely play in. You know, so if he wants to go full trial, knowing he's going to get convicted anyway, again, I always just keep coming back to Taylor Swift using her real life for all their song lyrics. You know, and he's doing the same thing. I mean, he's using his real life, his dual horrendously dark, evil life for his art. And so going through the trial. So I think if he wants to not share with the world the things he did and things he did to others, he would control it and plea out. But if he's proud of it, if he thinks it's part of his narrative of how he's living his life, he wants it exposed. So I think the plea, if he pleads or not, will be really telling on all that.
I think this is an interesting question here, and I want to give a quick answer before I toss it to you after I read it. They say this is from Steph via something. Where is it? This is from email. They said financial gain as a special circumstances. They're saying he allegedly ended a child's life to protect a music career. This is a line that gets me. How does a person get that far gone? And I think a lot of people are wondering that. How are you that far gone? How do you get that far gone? It's hard to get that far gone if you were never there to begin with. and I think that that's something that we forget, especially with some of these cases where they're this young. I mean, I know he's like, 21 now or something? This like 19 is earlier. So he was still a damn kid. He wasn't there. You can't get gone if you were never there. If you've just developed into this and you've had an ecosystem that has allowed you to become this, you were never gone. You're just functioning as you've been essentially bred, as you've been raised, as you've been conditioned, if you will, by your thinking, by your surroundings, you know, by a lot of different things. I don't know that some of these people were ever there to get gone. I don't know your thoughts.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever there either. So let's do our thought experiment right here. So here's someone that had a lot of early success before the prefrontal cortex fully formed, before the age of 24, which means we're highly emotionally impulsive. We're not really clear thinkers on things. And he had zero guardrails. Even though he comes from apparently a religious family, he didn't appear to have any guardrails whatsoever about what he could or couldn't do. He had all the wealth he needed to do whatever he wanted to do. He attracted more nutters around him, all before their prefrontal cortexes and lobes are fully formed. So they're all completely batshit crazy. Mm-hmm. And no guardrails. And then you have proclivity for doing horrendous things to underage people.
Yeah.
It was never there. I don't think there was a semblance of healthy thoughts that was in his life to that point. Before we saw started hearing some discovery stuff, I was on the camp. This human being couldn't possibly have done anything horrendous. It must have been a mistake, a cover-up. Again, prefrontal cortex not fully formed. You have a panic escalation to try to do something because you're mistaken, whether it's a drug overdose or doing stupid partying, whatever it was, and she died accidentally. Nope. I don't think that... I'm all on board with just broken from the beginning, no guardrails, and bad crap really happened.
There is a question here in the comments I wanted to go back to. It's about Celeste's parents.
I just did even more research on them too. A lot of people knew about David and Celeste's family.
This is one, and I'm not going down the road that they were paid or anything like that. But it says, yeah, so strange with Celeste's parents. She knew where she was. We don't know for sure, but they had listed her as missing. But it does seem a lot of people knew where the hell she was. She wasn't like missing in like the sense of she's on the side of a milk carton. Oh my gosh, where did she go? Like she was coming and going from the family dynamics here. Pretty much up towards the end.
Right.
Maybe not in a trunk or a Tesla. They let their little girl essentially live with a grown man. Why didn't they call the cops? Getting money? Maybe that's the question. And I'm not saying that. I'm not insinuating that. I think it's a fair question to ask. I think all that needs to be looked into, and I hope they already have. But yeah, I'm not in the camp here of just giving Celeste's parents a free pass here either. I know they're grieving. I know this is horrendous. I cannot imagine going through it, but there is responsibility to be had when you're a parent of a 13-year-old girl. She's not an adult, and sometimes you have to be a parent. I don't give a flying fuck how much you're working, how much you have to do this, how much you have to do that. Your number one priority is your child, and clearly by seeing the way the dynamics of this family worked, that child was not the number one priority, in my opinion. Your thoughts?
I agree. At the same time, This part confuses me, believe it or not. I mean, I keep all my research, and I literally before we came on, I researched her parents again, what they did, what they didn't do. I see the comments right here. The PI has evidence that her family knew where she was. Okay, maybe. There's so much that you and I wouldn't do, but
yeah.
But I'm gonna pull the Bob Mata on this one. Where okay. But we don't know them.
We don't.
And so I don't want to cast shade if they did do all what I read. I mean, it says here that they were in contact with police a lot trying to find her. But at the same time, to everyone else's point, everyone else seemed to know where she was.
She's showing up on security camera footage. She's showing up on video. I mean, it's not, again, she's not milk carton missing.
I don't get it. I mean, that's what I mean. I don't get it. I just, so, well, here's what I would expect. I would expect if they didn't give a rat's ass that there'd be one police report and not another. But we have multiples.
Mm-hmm.
But not multiples with tons of follow-up, it looks like. I mean, just like, see what I mean? It's just,
I think they gave a rat's ass to a certain extent.
Yeah. So I guess it's, you know, it's kind of like being on a spectrum. I think, you know, you have you and me and all our followers obviously getting a rat's ass, which is way up here. And then you have their family, which wasn't down at zero, but maybe like right around 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. I don't know.
The other area of this that I don't have the answer to that I think would tell us a lot about it is, and I'm just going to be very blunt about it, she was a missing brown girl. And we know how that works.
I think that plays into it.
In a lot of cases where if she's a missing white blonde girl, whoa, well, there you go. You're headline story for Ashley Banfield. But on something like this, and I'm not casting dispersions on Ashley Banfield, I'm just saying that's, you know, how that sort of shit works.
Right.
In terms of where attention seems to go. And even deeper, what people click on. People always ask, why do they only cover this? Why do they cover that? Because guess what? The public's interest, if we put out two different videos tomorrow,
totally
one was about this, one was about that. And I'm going to say, I really hope this one over here that's much worse about the little brown girl gets a lot more attention. Guess what's going to get more attention? Not that one. And that's not me. That's not you. That's society. That's the world doing what they do, making bad choices and not prioritizing every human as being on the same playing field. And that's shitty, but it is the world we live in. But I do wonder how much of that played into this in terms of the police response, the police investigation, before you got the rest of the world with talking about this, the podcasting, the news coverage of all of that. When she was missing for all of that time, before this murder took place, we didn't hear about it. We didn't really know this little girl was missing or that there was a connection to this star. None of that was a story. I'm kind of thinking it might have been if there was a little blonde white girl that had been hanging out with the music artist and then suddenly she's missing. That probably would have been a story. But for whatever reason, it wasn't. And I question, and I don't know the answer to this, but I do wonder what the response was from authorities of like, she's just a runaway. And it was just being handled like they do the other hundreds of thousands of runaway cases of, well, we hope she shows back up. Good luck.
So I definitely think that was part of it. We've seen it in too many cases for it to not be part of it. But I think it's one of a couple data points probably that led to this being the way it was. So you have that as a data point. Then I think also when you have private investigators or when you have people knowing where she is, and when whether the family knew directly or a 1 degree separation told the family, well, she's hanging out with this guy, David, who's this music guy, he's got a lot of money. And if you've got a chaotic life at home and you're dealing with a lot of chaos and trauma, and you know that one of your kids is not here, but I hear from the grapevine she's fine, you can rationalize not doing more about it. Again, pure conjecture, pure hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But when you put all these things together, cops aren't paying attention to it because it is what it is.
Yeah.
Then you have no pressing from the parents because we don't know what the cops knew about where she was or not, because they could have said the same thing. They said, well, if she's over here, because remember, everyone's always working with bandwidth. So here you have thousands of missing kids claimed, thousands. And you happen to know that the majority of the ones that are going missing, they're about to be trafficked. And you have one that's reported missing, but we know she's over here with this dude. Where, with limited bandwidth as a law enforcement professional, where are you going to focus? Where's the family going to focus? See what I mean? So it's I believe that probably too many people thought she was safe where she was when she actually wasn't.
It's a lot of looking back and coulda, shoulda, woulda, it feels 100%. Like in this case. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I don't know. I'm willing to hear anything in this case about how all of these things worked. I do not know the answers to these questions, but I think they need to be asked about the responsibility and what roles people were playing at what time in Celeste's life, or what they were not playing a role in where they should have been. These are fair questions.
And I'm still more on his parents
all
as
of
well.
Every damn one of them.
100%.
Every damn one of them.
Because they're all underage.
Yeah, I mean, David was 19 at a time. He was, yes.
I know legally we got that whole 18-year-old thing, but anyone old under the age of 24, I think, is an underage moron.
I agree.
Or potentially
mentally to be there as a responsible parent. Yes. This is a bad recipe. The whole damn thing is a bad recipe.
Yeah.
Young fame, suddenly falling into money, the shelter, the religiosity, the situation of celeb. I mean, everything is a bad. The whole damn recipe is shit. And when you mix all that together, you get something like this. And I think that's where we're at. Again, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work our way through it. Hey, here's another fun topic. Say it facetiously.
Coming home to the Duggars.
Oh, my God. The things nightmares are made out of, the Duggars. A child allegedly hurt by someone who was supposed to be safe. She carried it for years before she told anyone. And now we're talking here weeks after the arrest. The man who allegedly did this is back home out on bond, living under restrictions. He can't possibly follow without someone watching, and nobody watching. The family is fractured. Some are calling it evil. Some are calling it persecution. And the people closest to the victim are reportedly starting over with nothing. The legal system hasn't even gotten started yet, but the choices people are making right now, who they're standing with, what they're saying, and what they're not, are already telling us everything. You guys have had a lot of opinions about this, and there's a lot of very interesting reporting going on out there. This is like the soap opera from hell. There's the news element of it, and then it gets into soap opera material, literally. And it's like, I see a lot of it. This is going on around close to my ecosystem. So I'm trying to like not dive too deep into the soap opera, but it's hard not to sometimes. And I know you guys are having a lot of questions too. Joseph is home right now. He's bonded out. Bond conditions say no unsupervised contact with minors. He has four kids under 8. How does that work? Karen via Facebook. Well, he's not with their kids right now. The kids, and they're not with mom either. The kids are in protective custody, and the protective custody ain't family either, which I think to me, that says a lot. A lot of times when kids go into protective custody, they're going to look for family members. They're going to look for, would this be a good, safe place to put them? That's not where they went. And if my math is correct, there's 19 options as to where where those kids could have went, but they went to somewhere else, somewhere within the system. What does that say to you about what's going on here with this case?
I think there's a lot of leakage where law enforcement is taking a close look at everything going on here. And so, and Child Protective Services is obviously seeing it as well. So for some reason that they're seeing, they don't trust anyone in that family to have these kids. So that's a good sign for maybe they're inching their way towards justice. Maybe we'll see.
Maybe.
And you know, it's a really shame is that we know that there are a few that escaped that seem to us, especially since we interviewed Amy and we read Jill's book and Amy's close to Jill too, that because I don't like children in the system just because haven't seen good cases there either.
No.
So you really wish, and you know, and Amy said on our show that she would be more than happy to pitch in. She's offered as well. So again, there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of, like you said, soap opera stuff going on. I like that that they're not still in the toxic system, but at the same time, though, they can't be feeling too good. Those are four little babies that just are really hugely confused right now and probably scared too because they've been thrown into thinking one thing about the system they live in. And now, because we saw this in all the specials we watched, whether it's FLDS or IBLP, that they're so indoctrinated that anything outside of that system that doesn't exactly operate the way, you know, Grandpa Jim Bob told them, it's evil, it's horrible, I'm falling outside the umbrella. So there's got to be a lot of fear in their hearts as well.
I'm not pro let's throw them to the system either. If there's a good family member that can take care, that's usually your best option. But I think it's interesting if this is in fact how it's all playing out. Again, conjecture, our opinion, in my opinion, allegedly to everything we're talking about.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that that seems to be the dynamic, again, if that's accurate, as to where it's all playing out. Right now. I mean, it seems to say quite a bit. Here's another one. It says he allegedly confessed on a call. Apparently, he had no idea he was being recorded twice, basically. And then his lawyer turns around and they plead not guilty. Does that not guilty plea have any real shot, or is it just about buying time? Good question for Bob. Yep. I don't know where it leads. I mean, it seems most people do plead not guilty initially, and it usually ends up going to some sort of a plea deal of some sort, rather than just straight to guilty. It's another, you know, it's a situation where words don't mean what they mean in some cases, especially in the legal system, you know, or it's just utterly delusional. And he believes, under his way of thinking and reasoning in his mind, that he's not guilty of these crimes for whatever reason. He's been absolved of them by God, or I don't know. I don't know what the hell was going on up there to say not guilty when you've allegedly already admitted to this, other than this is just to run the clock down a bit while we work on the deal over here on the side.
It's really interesting. And what popped in my mind as we started talking about this just now, Tony, is Jim Bob's letter to Joe behind bars. Yeah. And it was very, very pragmatic and very law-like. Like, he was very saying, hey, bad things are happening. Again, he was diminishing the words and of the accusation and everything. But it's very much, hey, here's the law. You're going to be going away for a long time, most likely. So you can see that they're accepting of what the fate will be legally. But from everything we've seen, studied, and watched for this family for so long now, that doesn't seem to matter nearly as much to them as their faith and their IBLP methodology with, hey, we're all going to do bad things. We're not going to stir up the brethren. All you have to do to be redeemed is to admit your sin. You'll be redeemed because that's the most important thing. And now you can have a ministry. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Ministry is more important because that's the way you get into heaven. The only way you get into heaven is to be redeemed, have a ministry, and have lots of kids. This legal stuff doesn't mean anything, because you can do any, in their mindset, from what we understand from studying IBLP, you can literally do anything. If you seek forgiveness, it has to be given. If you're seeking forgiveness and you have to be redeemed, and that's all you got to do, and have kids, and you're going to heaven, which they think is a lot more important than going to jail.
And I think an important, interesting distinction there too is the forgiveness. It doesn't have to come from your victims. It just has to come from God.
No. The victims mean nothing.
Nothing. They're not even the damn equation.
Children are quivers.
As long as you go and speak to Sky Daddy, and Sky Daddy tells you specifically you're forgiven, or you just, this is what the form says. It says, I mean, if you ask for forgiveness, you will be forgiven if you believe.
And besides, the forgiven by the victims. Well, the victims are shamed into forgiving them because in order to keep under the umbrella, you have to show forgiveness.
Then they're in the wrong under the IBLP.
You see how stupidly cyclical this is? You have to forgive heinous acts by anyone, or you're going to fall outside the umbrella and not go to heaven and burn in hell. That's a belief system. That belief system is self-fulfilling prophecy of creating narcissistic S-freaks towards children.
Exactly. 1,000%. I just did a piece this morning, and I was addressing Joseph directly in it, because some of those jail phone calls, which are horrific to listen to, they're just so delusional in their nature.
Samson sorts Kendra. I mean, all you do is listen to that poor girl being basically tortured, and she has no idea she's being tortured.
No, yeah, it's yeah. I mean, it's painful. She's like, I'm getting an IV. I'm not eating. I can barely walk. And like, I'm reading Ruth about how I'm redeemed.
You need to read more Psalms.
Yeah, hey, read some Psalms.
Do you know the transfusion today? Yeah, who cares? Suck it up. Read more Psalms. Insane. You'll feel better.
It's spousal abuse, in my opinion, really just on like as blatant as you can get.
Actually, you want to watch Trauma Bonding Live? Listen to it. She's talking about how horrendous she is, and at the very end, she goes, "Do you love me?" "Well, yes, I do." "Oh, thank you for loving me." There it is. There's the one bomb and trauma, 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 little bomb.
Yeah, because that was a big tell on that, where at the end she's like, she's asking if he loves her.
He abused children And she's asking if he loves her.
You know, and this is why, you know, I said on the piece this morning that'll be dropping here tomorrow. Sometimes you got to fight fire with fire. And since he's speaking all biblically, I spoke all biblically right back at him. And I'm going with the Matthew chapter about putting the millstone around the child, the predator's neck, and dropping him in the sea. He skipped that part. He went right to Ruth and went right to the redemption, not the part of Jesus talking about, let's put the millstone and kick you off the boat. I like that one better. I think it's more applicable. It's actionable. It seems like it could be effective. It would solve a lot of problems. I say, let's go get a boat this weekend. Everybody can go out in it, you know, have a couple beverages, and there you go. Millstone. See you later, Joe.
You know, I'm giving a lot of credit to Amy Duggar King on her book, Holy Disruptor, on this one. She starts out the entire book on the first chapter countering all of Jim Bob's and IBLP's doctrine with other citations from the Bible that totally debunk everything that they stand for. So
she did a great job at that. Yeah,
she really did.
Yeah. Yeah, highly recommend. And if you've not seen our interview with Amy, that conversation, it is up here on our channels. Go and check it out. There's more to come, very likely, by the way, too.
Yeah, she's great.
So it should be, my God. All right, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear them. We'll try and get to them. I'll try and answer them online or in a future episode of the program here. Love for you guys to weigh in. Press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any episodes. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. There you go. It's worth reading. Joseph, this would be a good one for you, while you're on house arrest, you know, while you're sitting there. And looking for something to do. All right. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.